Hello, welcome to this podcast of the European Survey Research Association. My name is Vera Tupul, and today I'm going to discuss the future of survey costs together with two well-known experts in the survey field. My first guest is Jerry Nicolas. He's the director of methods at Knudsen Social Research, an independent social research organization in the UK. She has 30 years experience as a social researcher and methodologist in government, academia, and nonprofit, specializing in data collection methods. She has contributed to many high profile surveys in the UK, too many to sum up, but the health survey, travel survey, millennium cohort study, just to name a few. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you. Welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And my other guest is Joost Kappelhoff. He is the head of the methodology department at the Netherlands Institute for Social Research. He has been a member of the European Social Survey since 2005, and he's an expert in conducting large, both national and international surveys. Welcome, Joost.
Welcome. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yes. Jerry, my first question to you, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on the surveys that you have been working on.
Okay. Well, as you've already mentioned, I've been in this field now for over 30 years. So I've been involved in quite a few surveys over the years, including those high profile surveys that you've mentioned, but also many others. Initially, I would have been working on the day-to-day running of surveys, like the Health Survey for England way in the beginning in 1991. But now, later, as a methodologist, I've become more involved in the designs of the survey, the design stage, exploring new methods for surveys, as well as offering advice, including troubleshooting, those kinds of things. And the surveys I've been involved with include, well, mainly cross-sectional surveys, but also some longitudinal. They're mostly UK surveys, but also some involvement in cross-national surveys. And with regard to Mo, these surveys would have been mainly face-to-face with some telephone and some postal. But of course, in recent years, I've been working more and more on mixed-mode surveys, including web. So.
Thanks. Joost, what is the main survey mode in the Netherlands, the surveys that you are working on?
Well, that changed in the last decade, I would say. I think it started out mostly with face-to-face surveys. So we've conducted a lot of large-scale, based on national representative samples of general social surveys or general amenity surveys, and then a lot of surveys among hard to reach populations or hard to survey populations, ethnic minority groups, also sometimes surveys among hidden populations like transgenders. And then of course, a lot of, and then the European Social Survey as well with the large international component there, of course. And for the most part, it's been face-to-face, although as I mentioned before, about a decade ago, or maybe even more, and more the mixed mode surveys came up, mostly sequential mixed mode design, with some form of self-completion like web or postal, usually followed up by a face-to-face, and even then in the middle sometimes a telephone mode. So yeah, basically that's it.
And I think in general, the idea is that response rates are declining in a more or less linear trends. Is that also something that you have experienced in your surveys?
I can start. Yeah, we've seen a decline in response over the years. When you look at the figures, it varies survey by survey, but roughly maybe one percentage point per year. But, how low can they go, really? I mean, at some point you hit zero. We haven't reached that point yet, thank God. But yes, it is constantly a struggle. Whether it's strictly linear, it tends to be more bumpy, especially when you look at it on a survey by survey basis, because we're not just sitting back and watching these response rates decline. We're trying to minimize it. And so we keep changing our methods, making extra efforts to try and boost those response rates. And that might work for a little while, but then we see that decline coming in again. So it is a continuous battle to try and maximize those response rates. That is correct, yeah.
Joost, do you have the same experience?
I would agree on, in general, that would be the case. Although I do think sometimes it depends on the type. Let's say where you use modes that are, give people an easier out to not participate. been a mixed bag sometimes, but I think in general it's been you fix the amount you have available and you stick to your design as it is, then you tend to get a declining response.
And what type of efforts have you undertaken to in order to battle the declining response rate? Do you have specific examples?
Shall I go? Joost, you okay with me going first? Yeah. Okay. If we think, you know, historically, originally it would have been just increasing the amount of effort to find people and persuade them to take part. So if you look at the number of calls being made, for example, on face-to-face surveys per address, for example, you would see that's increased over the years. We're making more calls to find people, but also initially we would have then been reissuing unproductive cases, so reissuing them to another interviewer. So this has really increased the costs as well. A lot of cost goes into that. Then after that, when even that didn't seem to be enough, we started using incentives. You know, historically there was always a reluctance to use incentives on social surveys because we relied on the goodwill of the population and the social contract. That's changed a lot over time. So we're increasingly using incentives as well, and increasingly increasing the value of the incentives as well. But again, all of these methods, they tend to improve it to some extent, and then you see the decline coming in again. So now what we're looking at is things to do with the training and supervision of interviews. We're spending more attention on that. There was a lot of work done in this field around the beginning of 2000, I think it was, around that time in Michigan and also at the Office for National Statistics in the Netherlands. But there's been very little done in that field, and so we're going to be shifting our attention in that area to that area as well. We've also been spending more time looking at the communications with respondents. How do we communicate with them? How often do we communicate? What modes do we use when we communicate with them? So those are some of the things that we've been doing.
And push to web, is that a solution that you have undertaken in any of the surveys?
A push to web doesn't increase your response rate. we had that. That's mainly any move towards push to web is mainly motivated by the rising costs because of declining response. Response rates. And the idea is, of course, to try and get as many as possible, you know, the most willing people to go online and complete the survey, so that you can then focus your attentions on those who aren't taking part online and use your money in that way. So the idea is that you're using your money in a better way. So it's not so much to increase response, but it is a way of saving costs, which can then be used to increase response in a face-to-face mode or some other mode.
Joost?
Yeah, I would agree with Jerry as a given her experiences with this as well. It's very similar to ours, although I have to say that sometimes you find pleasant exceptions. For example, in the last ESS rounds, Germany did self-completion version compared to face-to-face, and they actually obtained a higher response rate than the face-to-face. So I would agree. I think there are many factors at play as well. I mean, especially what we see in the ESS, that many countries struggle to provide the capacity needed to conduct a single mode face-to-face survey. That's sometimes even a bigger problem, even if theoretically you would have the funds available and the design would allow for a large-scale survey, you would expect that you'd get a pretty high response rate, and just the struggle to find enough interviewers or to keep them active during fieldwork is sometimes even more of a struggle. So in that sense, we're doing all sorts of efforts along the lines that Jerry already mentioned. And then I think it's also taking more and more account the social reality that your potential respondents are living in, and especially when it comes to these hard to survey populations that we do a lot of research in the Netherlands, our institute does anyway. Then it is quite enriching in the sense of how you can design a survey focused, especially on if you adopt more targeted design, that you tend to focus your energy and effort and budget, allocate your budget in a way that would allow you to maximize response rates there.
Do you have an example of a targeted design?
Well, for example, that we have several minority ethnic groups in the Netherlands. And then we would use, of course, interviewers with a shared ethnic background, being able to speak the same language, also have translated questionnaires, which can be quite a challenge as well at times, because some of the groups we're targeting actually have no written language. So you have to have phonetically translated questionnaires, and people being able to read those phonetically translated questionnaires if you write them out. Exactly, the use of various modes. So, I mean, just basically you're trying to find a fight of the three biggest reasons for non-response, a refusal, non-contact, and not able, basically. And not able can be addressed in some extent, and not able also, of course, with the mixture of modes where you use, at least, especially if people don't have the basically the standard hours that you usually would, how would you say that? If you have a large-scale national survey, you sort of have an implied way of these are the accepted hours and ways of contacting people. And especially when it comes for newer groups, they don't necessarily share that, or they don't have to, they don't work at the same time. So you are sending your interviewer. So that type of thinking does help to increase and find appropriate targeted measures.
Could I just add something, because it was what you said earlier on about the ESS has had some really positive results in Germany as well. And we have had an example of that here in the UK. The Office for National Statistics have done some really interesting work in their prototype labour market survey, which will replace the labour force survey, and they've done a lot of testing and development, and because initially the response rate for this push to web with face-to-face follow-up was lower, but by manipulating different design features, they've over time improved it, and what they found in their latest test was that they were getting as good a response rate as the labour force survey. But I'm not so sure it reduced the cost though. And I suppose that's what we're talking about here, as well as the cost. I mean, I think it is possible to do things in other modes as well and to improve the response rate, but it does come with a price as well.
Yeah, and I think also for a long time, of course, people were very hesitant to use a web mode in case the questionnaires were fairly long. And now, at least during COVID period, you've seen a change there as well. So that does allow for some additional potential cost reductions that you get more people into that mode.
Because I think on the ESS, you carried out that experiment with the length as well, wasn't it? Yeah. And it found that, we've always been saying 20 minutes, maybe. Yeah. It's a really interesting topic. You might push up to 30 minutes for a web questionnaire, but what was it, 50 minutes?
Yeah, we had an experiment, and I think the longest one was 50 minutes, and it didn't really seriously impact the response rate. We've also, in the Netherlands, we've had similar experiences as well nowadays that we are conducting a large general social survey that also has a sequential design. And the thing is also, I think if you have a face-to-face mode, that tends to just to ask the same number of questions tends to take just almost 20% in time-wise longer than it would take you to conduct a face-to-face, to conduct a web survey. So in that sense, you sometimes are richer than you think when it comes to the number of questions you can ask.
Well, that's good news, because Jerry, you're right. I have been preaching to my students for 20 years to do a survey of about 20 minutes if they go online. And actually what I have been preaching the last couple of years is to reduce it to 5 minutes, because people are so fed up with doing online surveys. So it's good to see that if you have a good questionnaire, a good survey, that people can be you can get them in with even a 50-minute online survey. That's amazing.
We now, in collaboration with Statistics Netherlands, have this general social survey that face-to-face it takes about 40 minutes plus, and on average the web version, same amount of questions, takes about 32 minutes.
So that's a huge reduction, both for the respondent burden and also for the costs.
Exactly, and the drop-off rates are not that high. And you can tell, of course, which device you use. So you need to avoid people trying to complete those on mobile devices, because that's a bit challenging. But in general, people tend to do the web.
Do you tell your respondents to complete the survey on a regular desktop PC instead of a mobile phone?
I think in that particular one, it's suggested to do so, yeah. because it's just to the, and although we do in the design of the survey try to, of course, make sure that people who use smaller devices still have a pretty decent layout, but given the number of questions and sometimes the matrix type of questions, it's really hard to fit it on a mobile. So therefore you would advise them not to use that one.
Yeah, we've got the same thing. Well, on the whole, we would try to design the online questionnaire to be mobile friendly. So we wouldn't want to stop people from doing it on a mobile. But we have got the odd survey, which remains quite complicated, in which case we might not say don't complete it on a mobile phone, but we try and encourage them not to. Because at the same time, we don't want to exclude those people who can only take part if it is on a mobile phone. But yeah. Okay.
Different question. Do you ever use incentives for non-response conversion?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
It's in different ways, and some a bit more, maybe a bit more controversial than others. Sometimes at the reissue stage. So we've already done that first issue. We've worked the whole sample, but we still have unproductive cases. We want to push that response rate up. So we will then reissue those unproductives to a different interviewer if available. They're not always available. We might have to use the same one, but on the whole, we try to find a new interviewer, a new approach. And then we might then offer an incentive or a higher incentive than previously. Also, what we've done on some surveys is start thinking about who are the groups that are underrepresented in our service. Who are we trying to encourage to take part? And if people aren't taking part, mainly because they're not motivated to take part. So going on about the survey topic, well, we'd like to think that we could persuade people, but some people just aren't. Persuade. They just don't see the point of it. They can't see why it's of interest for them to take part. And that's when we might want to use an incentive as well to convert them. Whether you do that at the time is very controversial, because some people might say, well, that you're punishing those who are willingly taking part by not giving them the incentive. But what we can do is maybe target certain groups that we know are underrepresented in advance. And then we can justify, because we can kind of like say, you know, it's just so important to get these underrepresented groups in our statistics. The government wants these people included in the statistics so they can make informed decisions and improve policies. And so in order, if the incentive is the only way we're going to get them in there, that's we think that's a justification for doing it. And on the whole, we don't use very large values. It's not like we're offering hundreds of pounds. No, it's usually £5 or £10 that we offer. So it's just a little nudge, particularly for people who aren't motivated, but they don't have strong objections to taking part.
Joost, have you ever used differential incentives?
Yeah, pretty much along the lines Jerry's already sketched out, that especially in the reissuing phase, you tend to increase the amount of your usually unconditional or a conditional incentive. I mean, and sometimes we did at some surveys, you tend to think about which particular incentive might be more welcome to a particular group that you're interested in obtaining, or at least increasing their participation. But tends to be quite difficult, we found out. And also, of course, I think in many countries, there are limitations as to what you can do, especially when it comes to direct financial incentives.
Yeah, what is your experience when it comes to incentives when you're conducting an international survey?
Well, that's usually, in the case of the ESS, that's usually decided on the level of the national teams. So they would decide whether or not to give a conditional, unconditional, monetary or non-monetary incentive or a combination thereof. But they're free in their choice as to what particular non-monetary incentive. In some countries, it can be very useful to just give little trinkets, and others they might be more susceptible to a sort of lottery scheme, or that's what they're more accustomed to, and others just do a sort of general. We've had vouchers for supermarkets, I think, in countries, and one gave like a little laser pen that applied with the symbol of the research institute, because that's a really respected research institute, etc. So it really varies a lot. In that sense, it's quite interesting that it does show that one size does not fit all. Some countries, yeah, or some population are more susceptible to one thing than another.
Did any of you ever reduce the survey length in order to save costs?
No, I would say it's the other way around, because as long as face-to-face is part of your survey design, I think you're cutting in the hardest part is getting them there. It doesn't really matter if your survey takes 20 minutes or 30 minutes in that sense. If you're in the door, that's the part that you want to get.
Yeah. And if you're paying your interviewer by the hour in the home, really reducing the questionnaire length, it doesn't reduce the overall cost that much, because there's many travel costs with face-to-face interviewing.
But for online surveys, it might make sense.
If you doesn't really reduce, I'm not sure it reduce cost though. No. I don't know.
I think the fixed costs are, I don't think there's a lot of difference if your survey is 5 or 10 minutes longer. The variable cost, no. I don't think that makes a large difference. Okay. And especially if you calculate the cost per question. Then.
Mm-hmm. Any other ideas to reduce costs for our ESRA members?
I think, first of all, it makes a big difference what type of sampling frame country you are.
Oh, yeah.
In the Netherlands, we're blessed with, of course, very rich registry data, and being able to send letters out in person to somebody, it makes all the difference than compared to people handing over letters to the occupant of the building, or even having to walk, basically do a sort of random route almost to compile your samples. So I think that's a big difference.
Yeah, I'm very, very jealous, Joost, very jealous, because of course the UK, we don't have a population register, and we said we do address-based sampling. So all our letters are addressed to the occupant or that household or resident, something like that. And people mistake it for junk mail.
Exactly, and I think the incentive of the effectiveness of certain survey design choices, like you could at one point decide to set basically interviewers back to the door to motivate people to participate, which is way more effective if you know actually who you're looking for than basically having to knock the door and do the selection at the doorstep. So I mean,
And of course, with your population registers, you can also do your targeted efforts more efficiently.
Exactly. So that's what we've been doing, usually in collaboration with Statistics Netherlands, that you have a sort of targeted design where you think, okay, these particular groups, based on a sort of latent class analysis of some social demographic factors, you say, okay, it might not be as effective to first offer them web. Maybe we should just contact them face to face directly, or this popular part of the population does respond quite well to an invitation to participate via web. So we should not put our efforts in getting them to participate later on via face-to-face, because it doesn't really improve the response composition of our sample.
Yeah. I think we can do some of that, of course, some targeting on our longitudinal surveys based on information collected previously. There's been some exploring, whether we can target geographical areas, but the impact is small then, and you always worry about unintended consequences of doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And also the capacity of your field workforce is so determines everything if you're focused on or stuck with face-to-face as a mode.
Yeah.
Do you have more difficulty in hiring interviewers?
Oh yes, especially since the pandemic, because of course, even though we that has been involved in the COVID infection study that ONS runs. So we managed to keep a lot of our face-to-face interviews working on the COVID infection study. But nonetheless, that was the pool, and we weren't growing or recruiting or training new interviewers, or only to a limited extent. So coming out of the pandemic and needing to go back into face-to-face is difficult. We have to build up our pool of interviewers again. And that's what we're doing at the moment. But even previously, I think it was becoming more difficult to recruit. A lot of that's got to do with the labour market situation, what other jobs are available to people who might otherwise be willing to do some interviewing work. So that's become more difficult.
Yeah, it's been a similar experience, I think, both in what I know from the ESS countries as well as within the Netherlands. So, especially also during Corona, that you had sometimes the small windows of opportunity if you were actually able to conduct face-to-face surveys, and you're either confronted with hesitant sample persons or very hesitant interviewers not willing to enter the home or really a bit reluctant to do it. So that didn't help either. Based on.
It kind of like generates more innovations, because I mean that was some combinations of contact mode and data collection modes that we wouldn't even considered before the pandemic were happening. So for example, with the knock to nudge approaches, I mean, why send an interview all the way to an address to just knock on the door and persuade people to go online? We would not have done that before, because it made sense then to go in the home and collect it, because your response rate is going to be high, your data quality is hopefully going to be better. But of course that wasn't possible. So suddenly we were doing this combination. Now we're thinking, well, maybe there are certain situations that might still be a good idea moving forward after once we're out of this pandemic. But yeah. So there's been some positives coming out of it as well, being forced to try things that just wouldn't have made sense before. And the video interviewing, you guys have been doing video interviewing as well, haven't you, Joost?
Yeah. Also in collaboration with Statistics Netherlands, as well as within the ESS. But yeah, and it depends, its effectiveness depends very much also, of course, if you have a sequential mixed mode design. If web is part of your survey, video interviewing, I think, is maybe a little bit less effective, because you tend to catch those people in the other mode. But yeah, if it's as an alternative or as a sort of proxy for face-to-face mode, then yeah, it was at least for us quite effective.
Yeah, we found it more effective on our longitudinal surveys, where we already have a relationship with the respondents, and it's much easier to get them to go online, to go into the video. The cross-sectional surveys, very few people took it up.
And we've had varying degrees of success within ESS countries that adopted that particular approach, and whereas the rest of the design was quite similar. So sometimes it's also a bit of a country specific, and maybe it's the intensity and the harshness of the measures during COVID that also.
And I think the interviewer plays a role as well in doing it, that persuading.
Looking into the future, how do you envision survey costs? Will they rise until they explode?
Well, they won't be able to, because our clients won't be able to afford them. so there is a limit. And what we are actually seeing is that research budgets are decreasing. But the demands for more data, more granular data, quicker data, that's increasing. So there's a real tension there, which is why there is this increased interest in these other modes. Prior to the pandemic, there was, of course, great reluctance or hesitancy, risk aversion when it came to these existing surveys, because they're worried about their time series and whatever else. But now, with having had the pandemic, having had that break in time series, we're seeing more and more customers exploring the possibility of maybe changing their data collection modes. So that's what's happening now, to try to get a handle on the cost, try and reduce those costs, but still collect more data. The extent to which we can actually reduce costs that way is limited at the moment, because if you're doing a push to web design with the more expensive face-to-face follow-up for those who don't complete online, you still have to get a worthwhile proportion going online to get those cost savings. And quite often we're not seeing that immediately, but you can imagine that will change over time.
Yeah, I always think, I'm not sure if that is the right question or approach to look at it, because I think it's fairly straightforward. If you have a design that is at least uses for the most part face-to-face surveys, and you're not intending to change your design, just purely inflation will make sure that your costs will rise, besides all the additional difficulties. I think I would always sort of try to offset it to sort of quality indicator you use to say, given a particular level of quality I want to obtain, can I obtain it? And from that point of view, can I change my design? Are there innovations that might actually result in a lowering of cost? And I think also sometimes situational factors, like the point Jerry just made, that you have to have a large enough number of face-to-face contact attempts left to or a large enough sample of people that actually participates via web to offset those additional costs. But you have many interviewers that don't work just for one survey agency anymore. So those face-to-face survey interviewers, they tend to work for 3-4 organizations. And if their sort of allocated sample for them is large enough to work within a PSU, it might actually still be effective enough to even to have a small portion there. The interviewer can work on other cases as well. So, I mean, I think people get more innovative in that way. And if you're confident that your quality is more or less above the threshold that you want it to be, then the question doesn't necessarily become whether or not survey costs would increase indefinitely. I think it's different. And in the ESS, I would say that if we are going to go to a push to web mode, or mostly self-completion, either web or postal, then yeah, I think in principle, for many countries, the potential, there might be a potential cost reduction, not that much. People tend to think that they tend to overestimate how many savings they get. But if the length of the questionnaire can be the same and you have the infrastructure at place and you have the survey agency that's very capable and has shown that they can do it for those countries, that might be, yeah, actually might stop the increase in costs, and the sample composition, also the quality of the answers can be fairly high as well. So,
yep.
A bit of a...
And how do you see the rise of new data sources, such as social media, or maybe even using apps for data collection? Do you see them being taken into account in your surveys, or is that still a bridge too far?
Well, we're exploring them. We have been looking at all these different data sources, also social media data. I've got a colleague who, Curtis Jessup, who's been working at with the people at the University of Essex using Twitter data alongside. I mean, it's all early days, I think. I don't think that it will ever replace survey data, but it's whether it can be used alongside survey data. It might be useful for reducing respondent burden as well. But that also applies to all other types of data sources as well, administrative data sources. Of course, if you're doing a push to web survey or an online survey, getting consent to do these kinds of linkages is very low. That's been the main problem, I think, of using these other data sources, is getting respondent consent.
Yeah, exactly. We've had experience as well that I think data that could be collected in a passive way by people just allowing certain setting to be installed on their mobile, they tend to not do that and rather do it themselves actively, whereas it takes them more time and work than, but they have at least have a sense of control about what they're sharing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to continue to be a challenge, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially if you try to do all this online as well, because I think that's where trust comes into it. I think that's our biggest barrier at the moment with online, is gaining that trust from respondents to provide information as well as consents and other bits and pieces.
Yeah, and isn't that also a downside, that providing more information actually scares people off?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not, I suppose it's not about providing too much. Yeah, not too much is the wrong way of phrasing it, but if it's about informed consent, isn't it? And just by providing pages and pages of information does not mean it's going to be informed consent, because people won't read it, they won't understand it. And also the language being used, they might be perfectly okay with doing something, and just by raising these issues, people start thinking, oh, maybe I was too quick, maybe there is a problem here, maybe I won't do it. It's definitely about getting the balance right. You see that quite often in face-to-face surveys as well, that we send out advanced letters and sometimes with leaflets, particularly if it's a health-related survey with lots of, information about what's going to be done and how it's going to be done, and you can, you know, lots of information which can be very off-putting, and the interviewer turns up, and if the respondent has read the advance letter and leaflet, you know, the interviewer suddenly has a much harder job to persuade them and to reassure them, because they've already read this information or read it in their own way and maybe got the wrong end of the stick there. So yeah, can backfire.
I do think sometimes for this, the different types of data you can collect, if you can make some of that information accessible for the interviewer. I think even you were involved maybe as well in this, Vera, about like mobility, about how people move, if they get a sort of overview on a weekly basis about, okay, basically this is what you do in the day, or when it comes to time use surveys, mm-hmm. to get some sort of direct feedback. Okay, you report this, but this is actually what you do. So if you want to change your behavior, that might be that might persuade at least some people more, but maybe you just get a very selective group that is willing to learn from their behavior. But
in my experience, people, they like feedback, but it never actually increases response rates. And sometimes I'm actually scared that it might influence their behavior.
Yeah, for longitudinal survey, that would be disastrous.
Yes, exactly. And I'm currently working on physical activity, which is also something that you don't want your respondents to be aware of, that they think they need to increase their physical activity in order when they are completing your survey. So mm-hmm. yeah, feeding respondents feedback is also difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's also a difference between sort of self-reported or subjectively evaluated behavior compared to actual shown behavior, and that tends to measure something different at times as well, especially if you sort of more direct measures on like heart rate or whatever. That,
yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I think we're going coming to the end of the podcast, but not before I ask you another important question, I believe. So this podcast is for the European Survey Research Association. So do you have any suggestions for future research when it comes to increasing response rates or reducing survey costs that our ESRA community can take on?
I've got a wish list. I'd like more methodological research in combining probability and non-probability samples. I think we're having increased difficulty in including, you know, inclusivity and accessibility for all groups in the population when we're just doing random probability sampling. The only way to get all these groups in you know, properly represented would involve a lot of cost, lots of boosts, etc. There's all impact on cost. If we can find a way of combining non-probability samples, which might be better at getting access to these people, and combining that with our probability samples, that might be a help. So more research in that area. Also adjusting for mode effects. I think we'd probably see a lot more mixed mode surveys if we knew, first of all, we would try to reduce any differences in measurement through design, but that's not always possible. So where it's not possible, coming up with practical ways of adjusting for measurement differences. There are things that can be done, but they're not useful for ordinary data users. You have to be quite technically savvy in order to use them. And just a plea for more cross-industry collaboration. So academics, people from survey agencies like myself, government to work together, but also customers, getting clients, survey commissioners involved in thinking about these issues. Also just to understand that just wanting more data, more granular data, quicker data, that has an impact on the costs. But if the research budgets are decreasing at the same time, we need to be realistic about what we can do. And there's only so much you can do with a survey. Sometimes we expect too much also from survey respondents.
I'd be hard pressed to find some additional topics of interest, but I would it was fairly extensive. But I think personally, I think what's also interesting is, of course, now national borders tend to dissipate in with respect to particular topics of interest. You have a large part of your population or your national population that doesn't necessarily live within your borders or vice versa. And so if you want to have a particular design targeted at a particular group that doesn't necessarily adhere to the national borders, that type of how can you combine different sampling frames to sort of be able to capture as much of that population? These type of things I think are really, really interesting and quite needed sort of coverage issues as well, of course. And the other thing is, I think also you'd have still in many countries you don't have a really good sampling frame, or at least you'd be in many situations left with the situation that an interviewer is going to be an integral part of your sampling design, to, you know, doing the final selection of which person to interview, etc., or doing a random route to basically just decide about your sample. The research into the quality of that, and especially the effectiveness of things like last birthday methods, etc., these are quite interesting and relevant as well.
Yeah, particularly when we're moving to push to web and stuff. I mean, that we have no interview involvement. Exactly. It's incredibly difficult. Yeah.
All sorts of innovative ways to keep finding out that you're actually the person that participated is actually the right person for you, or you have some corrective measures post hoc that be, I think, a field worthwhile investigating.
Okay, thank you so much, both of you, Jerry and Joost. I think this is the end of the podcast about the future of survey cost. And thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And see you in another ESRA activity soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.